Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, June 8th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of our show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Tracy Barone about her new novel, Happy Family. But first up, Asali Suliman. Asali's first book, the story collection Get Down, earned her a Rana Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. In 2007, she was named one of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35. She teaches English at Haverford College. Her latest book is the novel Disgruntled, out in paperback by Picador, recently released. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Asali.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So let's begin by having you introduce your book to us. Would you tell us about Disgruntled?
So Disgruntled is a coming-of-age story about Kenya Curtis, who is growing up in West Philadelphia at the start of the novel, around 7. There's a family implosion, and she finds herself sort of exiled in the suburbs. And it sort of goes on from there, looking at different scenes from her coming-of-age.
Right. And when you start the novel, and for a good period of time, Kenya is a relatively young narrator. I mean, in the beginning, she's in elementary school. And I'm so curious about young narrators. Was that a particular challenge?
So it wasn't. I mean, so for one thing I should mention, the book is in third person, so she's a protagonist, not the narrator. But in some ways, the novel is her voice in a lot of ways. But I have to say that actually a lot of what I wrote is is about younger people. So I'm actually trying to force myself to face the challenge of writing about adults from a more adult perspective. But there's something about my mind that has been caught in about seventh grade, so I actually find that much easier to do.
And the setting of the novel is mainly the 1980s, and there are so many details. So you have TV shows and music and candy. I mean, the Prince references were bittersweet. And,
yeah, right.
Yeah, and games, Miss Mary Mack, and references to like Tilt-A-Whirl, all these things. So it's almost a period novel. And so did you have to research to find those references, or were you able to conjure them for your memory, or how did that work?
Yeah, all that stuff tended to basically come from my memory. Now, there were some things I had to research because I wasn't sure about some of the specific details of them. For example, there's a part that mentions the MOVE fire, which was an event that took place in Philadelphia in the 1980s. And there were some details about that I wasn't quite sure of because of how young I was at the time. But a lot of that stuff, thinking about like tree-torn sneakers or various pop songs, like that stuff basically came from memory.
Mm. So, Asali, would you read to us from the book?
Yeah, sure. So I will read from the first couple of pages. In the first grade at Henry Charles Lee School in West Philadelphia, when Kenya told kids that she celebrated Kwanzaa, no one knew what she was talking about. By the third grade, led by the tiny tyrant Letitia Simmons, the kids were calling her an African booty scratcher and chanting to a conga line rhythm. You don't get no presents. You don't get no presents. In fact, she did get presents on the last morning of Kwanzaa, 7 days after Christmas. By the fourth grade, Kenya was down to just one friend. It wasn't just the Kwanzaa problem. In any way, she could have lied about Kwanzaa like she suspected Fatima McCullers did. Fatima, whose dad had dreadlocks and who always said Christmas and Santa Claus with a wavering inflection. It was also that Kenya couldn't eat any pork, including the bologna sandwiches that were the everyday fare in the lunchroom. Something to do with her father muttering that white people forced slaves to eat hog guts. Though as far as Kenya could see, white people loved bologna enough to give it both a first and a second name. Should I continue?
Oh, would you just a bit more?
Sure. It wasn't just the bologna problem. It was that she wasn't allowed to watch Give Me a Break, Good Times, or Different Strokes because, according to her mother, watching black people on TV acting the fool was worse than not watching any at all. It was that she was forbidden to speak the Pledge of Allegiance and had been directed to mouth it with her hand, not actually touching her chest. It was that she had to call her father Baba, and when she'd asked if she could call him Daddy like other people, it had triggered what seemed like days of lectures, during which Kenya learned to hate the phrase other people. It was that while her parents said grace like normal people, they directed it to the Creator instead of God. It was that she was never, ever allowed to say the N-word, even during the step where they had to say N-word boy. In fact, when she first heard someone say it in school, Letitia Simmons in the third grade, Kenya said, ooh, expecting everyone to join in. They didn't. Even Aaliyah, the pale girl from Sudan, actual Africa, but no one called her a booty scratcher, with a long rope of hair, was laughing at her. And when Kenya pointed at Letitia explaining she said the N-word, they laughed even harder.
Thank you. That was Asali Solomon reading from her novel, Disgruntled. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Can we talk some more about Kenya? So how did you go about developing her character? She has a lot of opinions and we get access to her mind, although it is close third, as you pointed out. But can you talk some more about her as a character?
So I think actually Kenya developed mainly out of the kinds of scenes that I was interested in writing. That is to say that I didn't actually think, obviously I'm thinking about her characters, I'm writing her, but I basically form characters out of writing events and in some ways out of writing plot. And I think that a lot of the things about her suggested themselves to me as I moved along in the writing. So rather than planning ahead of time, you know, in terms of thinking about, oh, she's going to be like this, she's going to have these opinions, those things would sort of present themselves to me organically as I tried to work my way through the material. And a lot of that came from images that sort of appeared to me and appealed to me, or different phenomena that I was just kind of interested in, things that I've observed. And so I would say that that was kind of how she developed. I was conscious of wanting to make her an interesting character, so that was something that was deliberate, meaning that in a lot of cases, the character who is the sort of protagonist runs a risk of being the least interesting character in a book. So you often have minor characters who are much more interesting or, you know, like compelling in these different ways, whether they're evil or whether they're good or whatever, whereas the protagonist is kind of can sometimes be a bit of a blank slate. So I wanted to make her, you know, sort of defined, you know, like a little bit more memorable.
That's so interesting. And I was struck when you said that you form your characters out of writing plot, because one thing I learned about your process was that you've said that plot was daunting. I mean, this is your debut novel. You had the story collection. And can you talk some more about your approach to plot then?
Well, so plot was very daunting, and it was actually the thing that really stymied me for a long time. It took a very long time to write this book. But when I think about her character coming out of plot, I think about episodes, actually. And that was actually what allowed me to be able to write the book. I knew that it was going to be something pretty episodic, and there wouldn't be a really sort of strong, cinematic, overarching plot in some ways. And so I would think about, well, what would happen at the school dance, or what would happen at the sleepover, or what would happen, you know, with this argument with her parents. If I thought about it sort of scene by scene and thought about the sort of mini plot of those scenes, that was how I was able to create her character, and that was ultimately how I was able to write the whole book.
And so what was your process with the first draft? Did you just survive it and plow through and then revise after that?
A lot of time writing and rewriting like the first 20 to 50 pages, and then I got, you know, I got like sort of maybe about 40 pages, and I showed them to a good friend, and he thought, well, this kind of looks like a novel to me, why don't you just see if you can take this a little further? And so I kept writing from there. So I worried the first bit for years, you know, and then after that I basically just plowed through it. And but a lot of the way I did that was by writing things that interested me. So I would skip around a lot. You know, I would think, oh, I think this thing will happen, you know, later. And then I would just write that instead of writing the sort of connecting bits. And then when it became a complete draft, then I had to sort of go back and fill in a lot of the connections.
when you say that it took you a long time, that's relative on this show. Can you tell us how long it took?
So I think this book kind of from start to finish in a lot of ways took about 8 years. I was not consistently writing during that time, and you know, I moved a couple times, I got married, I had 2 kids, a lot of other things happened. But overall, in terms of thinking about when I sat at a desk and said, okay, I'm working on this novel, and when it, you know, was published, it was something like 8 years. So that seems like a long time to me.
I didn't realize that in the process of writing this book, you became a mother, which is striking because of Kenya's fraught relationship with her mom.
Right.
And those first 40 pages that you mentioned, did you know from the outset that that would probably be a novel-length work, or did that surprise you?
Well, when I was working on it, I was contracted to write the novel when I published a short story collection, so I knew I had to write a novel. When I was working on those first 20 pages, I felt pretty dire about them, so I wasn't thinking, oh, this is going to, you know, this is going to be it. I assumed that was going to be another draft that I wound up throwing away. But it's funny because I'm fairly sure that the beginning of that turned out to be the beginning of the novel.
We talked about the setting era-wise, and also in this book, place is so important. So, I mean, in particular, you talk about West Philadelphia and the Main Line. Can you talk about the role that place played in Kenya's story?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short story collection that I wrote is also almost exclusively set in Philadelphia and the Main Line. And I think that I really spent a lot of time thinking about these places, partially because they, you know, I'm from West Philadelphia, and I live in West Philadelphia now, and I also still spend a lot of time on the Main Line because I teach out here. And I think that they're interesting places in a lot of ways, but I also think that the things that I'm thinking about in terms of racial identity and sort of group identity and class and, you know, these sort of microcosm of social interactions is something that is not in any way unique to this area, but is a way to think about a lot of these things in a representative way. So, you know, I think people throughout the United States could sort of understand different aspects of, like, the different cultural clashes or the different, or, you know, issues of economic equality or racial inequality or racial division. But the other part of that is that I'm a great fan of the writer Edward P. Jones, who wrote 2 short story collections about Washington, D.C. And from him I got the notion that you could make the place that you were writing about and the place that you were from kind of mythological simply by putting it into your fiction and sort of naming street names or naming, you know, different buildings or talking about different neighborhoods. And I was sort of enchanted by that idea. And so it's something that I really kind of run with.
You have an MFA, right?
Yes.
And do you have a PhD as well?
Yes.
Yes, and can you talk about how education influenced your writing? Because we talk a lot on this show about whether or not an MFA, you know, is worth the time and the investment, and the pros and cons. And so, I'd love to hear your experience with education.
So, I would. What I wound up doing, I got a PhD, and then directly after that, I got an MFA, was not a grand plan at all. I knew that I wanted to write, and I thought that if I got a PhD, that would be a sure way to earn a living, and that would be the way that I supported myself as a writer. And I wasn't aware at the time that getting a PhD is an entirely different enterprise. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, if you go to a PhD program and tell people you're a creative writer, you know, people do not want to hear about that and don't actually think that, you know, you have talent. And you know, it's kind of a waste of time. That being said, I made a significant connection during my PhD program with the writer Bharati Mukherjee, who was a great, who is a sort of... a great mentor for me. And so I did do some work on my writing there, but basically focused on the literature. And what was great about that, what was terrible about that for me as a writer, was that at the time that I was working on the PhD program, you are in such an evaluative mode, and what you're evaluating are things that are considered the classics of literature written in English. It can be very hard to produce your own writing. But what's great about it is you read a lot of things that you probably would not have read on your own. And so I feel like really fortunate to have a sort of deeper knowledge of literature in English than I would have had if I hadn't, you know, done the PhD program, and particularly thinking about what it means to be an African American writer, what it means to be an American writer, and thinking about that tradition and thinking about the different contributions that writers have made, but also doing things like spend a lot of time reading Victorian literature, which I really love for its sort of soap opera gossipiness and real obsession with social mores. So I think the PhD contributed that to me, like a sort of deep knowledge of literature that I'm ultimately participating in. MFA programs, I think that there's not, these days, it seems as though most people who become published as mainstream writers have participated in MFA programs. That's to say that fiction writing has become quite professionalized in that way. And so, you know, I tell students that in a lot of cases, if what they want to be is a mainstream writer of fiction, an MFA seems to be, more often than not, seems to be a key to doing that. So that's sort of bracketing the issues of whether or not it makes for better writing. I mean, I think that what can be great about MFA programs, or what was great about mine, is that I had 2 years to write. And I made connections with some really great writers. Elizabeth McCracken was the writer that was a writer I've learned a lot from and continue to learn an enormous amount from, who I met at Iowa. And she was a great mentor. I think sometimes it's not clear that you will get a really great, strong mentor out of those programs, but the best that can come out of that is really sustained writing time.
Hmm. And I think it's relatively rare, right, though, to have the PhD in addition to that. And I'm curious whether that vein of academic study, did it place any kind of a burden on you that you feel?
It didn't. At the time, as I was saying, it made it difficult to think about fiction writing. But it's funny because when I was doing it, I sort of thought of myself as closing off the door to becoming a creative writer, because at that time it seemed to me it was relatively rare for, you know, fiction writers who were actually publishing or I actually knew about to have PhDs. I think it was something that seems a little bit more frequent are poets with PhDs. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I thought, well, this is sort of somehow that was going to shut down my ability to be a creative writer, but it didn't, and I don't think of it as a burden at all. And in some cases, I mean, to be very unromantic about it, it can help with an academic job search, and a lot of writers wind up teaching at colleges and universities, and it can really help to have a PhD.
That's interesting. And you do teach in both, right, in English and in creative writing?
Yeah. So where I teach at Haverford College, the creative writing is a part of the English department. And so, but yes, I teach fiction writing workshops as well as literature courses. Yeah.
Can you talk about, as someone so familiar with looking at craft from all levels, do you have any writing advice to offer the writer listeners out there?
Yeah, I mean, the main advice I have about being a writer, it sounds glib, but it's actually my best advice, is write. Because I think that a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about writing. I'm one of them. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the project that I'm supposedly currently working on now, but not writing it. And the only way to really become a writer, the only way to achieve anything, is to actually write. And I think that you know, like, we feel like we don't have time, but you can always make space for something that you feel that you're truly committed to doing. Beyond that, I really do think it's about finding communities of people that you can share your writing with. because then that also gives you sort of, you know, can force you into a different kind of accountability. But I really, honestly, it's the advice I give my students as well, like, write.
Is that a nice way of saying suck it up?
No, it's a nice way of saying, like, you know, people say, yeah, I want to write, but it's, are you writing? You know, write. That's the only way to do it.
Well, Asali, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
That was Asali Solomon, author of the novel Disgruntled, out in paperback, published by Picador. During the second half of the show, Tracy Barone will be here, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other shows and interviews up on the web and available via podcast from Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with author Asali Solomon. Next up, debut novelist Tracy Barone. Tracy earned her MFA in dramatic writing at NYU and has worked as a screenwriter and playwright. She's worked in Hollywood, where she was the executive producer on Wild Wild West, Rosewood, My Fellow Americans, and Money Train, and was instrumental in the acquisition and development of Men in Black and Ali. Her debut novel, hot off the press, is Happy Family, published by Lee Boudreau Books. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Tracy.
Hey, Nicole. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. And I'm so looking forward to talking about Happy Family. Could you start us off by introducing the story?
Absolutely. It's a story of one very dysfunctional family, the Mastner family, that is has many components to it, many secrets, lies, and as my character, Sheree Mastner, says, you need a flow chart to know who did what to whom in my family. And like many families, my character, Sheree, does not know the secrets of her origin. She was adopted. She doesn't know the mystery of how she was born or how she came to be adopted. And it's basically the story of how, at age 40, she's marriage is crumbling. She was a former cop turned academic and has been kind of running from a secret in her own past. And she's at a kind of what's it all about Alfie moment where nothing in her life is working, and she has to start reexamining very reluctantly pieces of herself and the narrative she's always told herself about her family as she's desperately trying to start one of her own and finding that she can't have a child.
And I'd love to talk some more about the character of Sheree, because she's so complicated emotionally and in other ways. And so how did you go about developing her?
Well, I wanted to write somebody who's very real or very sort of, you know, at least for my generation, it's like, you know, I was taught, like, you could bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan, that kind of thing, you know, and you could have it all. And the truth is you really can't. And Sheree is this sort of walking dichotomy. And I had had a friend in high school and college who had also done this sort of abrupt turn. We were studying, among other things, comparative religion. I went to NYU. And she made this sort of U-turn into being a cop in the housing projects in New York City in the 80s. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. You know, we are not all one thing. So what makes especially a woman who's, and I shared some of these similarities, who was fiercely independent, wanting to really make a name for herself in a man, predominantly man's world, both in as a police officer and also as in academia. And she's a professor of comparative religion, but deals a lot with archaeology and ancient Mesopotamia. And so those qualities, you know, wanting connection but pushing it away with both hands, you know, yearning to have a child on one hand, but also because she was adopted, wondering about did she inherit the propensity to abandon her young, because obviously she was given up. So all of these complicated emotions, and these were things that made me, as I was developing the character of Sheree, were kind of tugging on me to sort of go deeper into that.
That really interests me because, and I mean, I don't want to talk about your personal life, but I did read your account of your experience as an accomplished woman in Hollywood and then becoming a mom, and you had your own kind of U-turn and the blowback from that.
Yeah, I mean, I started off as a writer. I was a playwright and I was a screenwriter, and I was, you know, I was very much, I did like performance art down in the Lower East Side back in the 80s. And, you know, then I kind of went into Hollywood and I started telling people other people's stories and made a lot of sort of, you know, movies with a lot of moving parts and a couple of superheroes or two. And I kind of lost my voice. And I think sometimes you have to step away from something, even if you're very successful. And, you know, people certainly told me you're never going to work again. And, you know, take that risk. And, you know, my character does that as well. And I think sometimes when you do it, it's really scary. And, you know, often you feel like the rug's pulled out from under you. But, you know, that's, I think, when the deepest work is done. And that's certainly, I wouldn't have been able to write this book if I had, you know, the idea that you can juggle careers is a great concept. But for me, I definitely couldn't have been doing it until I found some quiet. And that took me a long time to find.
I'm talking to Tracy Barone, author of the new novel, Happy Family. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Tracy, would you read to us from the novel?
I would love to. I'm going to read you a passage. This is my character, Cherie. As I mentioned, she's having trouble in her marriage, and she's decided that she's going to leave her husband, Michael. And just as she's decided that she's going to leave, the man that she had sort of become completely disenfranchised from turns back into the man that she loves, as he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so she's sitting here and contemplating life and him. It's the afternoon, and she hasn't even had breakfast. Is this the soiled linen of working at home? Too much time to think, wearing the same clothes for days, forgetting to do up her belt after going to the bathroom, and then thinking, why bother? Soon she'll be that woman at the post office, dressed in black jeans and a work shirt, middle-aged, with no husband or kids, just parcels to post. She looks out the window and is startled to see Michael at the far end of the lawn. It is sunny but cold, and he's wearing sweats and a wool cap. His arms extend above his head, palms facing each other, fingertips reaching toward the sky. He goes through a series of poses, bending over in a swimmer's stance, leaning on one leg, standing with his hands folded as if in prayer. She's seen him do yoga hundreds of times, has come to think of it as yet another practice that leads to avoidance rather than integration. Yet here he is, alone on a cold winter's day, saluting the sun. He stands in this moment, on this day, in gratitude, humility, in spite of. We are capable of such great acts. We rise up even when our legs are almost too weak to hold us. We claw our way out of darkness and isolation with just the memory of light to guide us. We find ways to practice our faith even when we're hunted because of it. We are all so vulnerable, so close to nothingness, and yet we survive. It fills her with a reverence for the terrible and beautiful experience of being alive. She closes her eyes and thinks she can see the daisy chain of all beings, trees and wind and sea, sunlight and the reflected light of stars that burned out long ago. She imagines lines like arteries and veins, the spinning helix of DNA forming an infinite superhighway of energy running through her hands and into Michael's and up beyond space. Michael loses his balance and folds himself into the child's pose. Cherie is ashamed of how quickly she goes to judgment. She's ashamed of all of the conceptions, right and wrong, she's ever had about this perfectly familiar and yet still unknown man. Oh, Michael, she thinks, I'm sorry.
Thank you. That was Tracy Barone reading from her debut novel, Happy Family. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And yes, I mean, that change in her relationship with Michael is really gut-wrenching when he takes, well, we won't plots below. But
spoiler alert.
But okay, let's. What we also see from that passage is that the novel is largely in present tense, and that's always an interesting choice for me when it happens. Was that an obvious one for you from the get-go, or how did you come about that?
That's such a good question. You know, I did this very purposely. I wanted to create a story because it goes, you know, the first section is my character Cherie's birth and her, basically her adoptive parents' story that she knows nothing about. And then I make this jump 40 years into the future, into 2002, which would be the present day of the novel. And I catch you up on what happens very slowly and kind of put you in media res into Cherie in middle life and just kind of take it from there. And I wanted to do present tense because I feel like, first of all, it's so much more immediate. But even when you're talking about the past, when you have a memory of something, you know, you remember it in present tense. You know, you don't really have a memory. Obviously, there is no tense in memory. But when you have it, especially when you go back and you're thinking of something, you're right there. And so as much as I wanted to deconstruct and reconstruct and reinterpret the various narratives and points of view of this family story, I wanted to do it as much as possible in present tense and put the reader immediately in those scenes.
Hmm. So you said that you very slowly catch us up with what's gone on, but I want to hear more about how you consciously paced this novel, because it's fascinating in all that it covers and the speed, how it does slow down or get reflective, but it all builds. It's always building. Mm. So can you talk about how conscious that was, or decisions or concerns when you were pacing the novel?
Very much so, because, you know, the novel goes 80 years. And I think, you know, you don't want to be Dickensian about this and sort of go, although I love Dickens, you know, the idea that you don't want to sort of start at a birth and then just go a straight narrative. So I wanted to be able to take you, like I said, I wanted to plunk you down and meet, you know, Cherie, who's a baby, and then meet her at 40 and see her there. And then deliberately kind of go back when it made sense to go back, right? And it's as a writer, finding those moments and finding the right pacing, because you want to keep the present story going. And at the same time, you want to be able to go into these key moments in her past that will illuminate not only who she is today, but as she's kind of making sense of her own life. So I kind of charted it a little bit with her own, you know, she's very reluctant, as much as she is wanting to look at, she has an ancient mystery she's trying to solve in Iraq. That's her work storyline. But she's very reluctant to look into her own motivations and her own past. So I like having a character who doesn't want to go backwards, but the narrative is taking you backwards. And I wanted to sort of parallel that, so that you would constantly have the tension between that, revealing things she didn't know about herself. And as she's kind of struggling with those issues as they're surfacing in the present.
And this is your first novel, but you have experience as a playwright and a screenwriter. So did you draw consciously from any of those skills that you developed in those forms?
Well, I love, you know, dramatic writing is kind of was my first love. And I think, you know, as I do love scenes, you know, I think in terms of telling a story and writing the novel, creating scenes and writing dialogue, you know, those were things that I so trafficked in especially as a playwright, you know, and a screenwriter, everything's dialogue, right? And the across the pages and is important. So this was so liberating for me that I get to paint this wide canvas, but still use skills, more cinematic skills or more, you know, painterly skills that you would get through visual storytelling. So it was really fun for me to blend it.
Mm. And I would love to hear more as well about the character of Cece, Cherie's mother or adoptive mother.
Yes.
She's Italian, and she has a distinct voice, and she uses malapropisms or mistranslates cliches. Mm-hmm. And so from a linguistic point of view, I was curious. Well, first of all, do you speak Italian?
I speak a little bit. I mean, I probably speak as much worse Italian than Cece speaks broken English, you know. But I did spend a bunch of time in Italy, and I had a lot of Italian friends. And I think, you know, the immigrant experience and, you know, so many people of Cece's generation, they would come here and, you know, wanted to assimilate, but also wanted to keep their roots. And in Cece's case, you know, in order to marry Saul, she had to kind of give up her family and her religion. And the whole idea of the borrowed dress one all wears from the family, one's family of origin, whether it's in religion or, you know, because was she a Catholic only because her parents were Catholic? What does religion mean? What does it mean to Cece? You know, and I think those are themes that I explore with her character. And she's somebody who very much, you know, is, without giving too much away of what happened, but, you know, she's very old school in terms of having more old school values. And she comes over to the U.S. when she's, you know, 19 years old and has a tragedy and in some ways never really recovers. And I think that her yearning to both be part of the new world but really missing her family. And you go back to Italy, and she sees her family in the novel as well.
With her speech quirks, I'm intensely curious. Did you keep a notebook then of your Italian friends, or did you just work with cliches?
You know, I did, and I had it's funny because we were recording the audiobook, and I have a lovely friend, Claudia, in Rome, and she actually would speak into you know, the voice recording on the iPhone, and she would record, say, can you just tell me the broken English so I get it right, so it doesn't sound like a Prego commercial, you know? And it's always when you're writing, you know, I made a decision when I was going to write in broken English for Cece. That was always a bit of a scary thing, right, because it can come out sounding sort of fake or cliched. And to try to get the nuances right, because she doesn't, you know, the idea that she never fully learns English. And I know a lot of people of that age who never really did, you know, and they spoke like that. So I did have help. I had friends who would speak into a dictaphone, and I would kind of make sure I got the nuance right in the language, or try to. And the actress who actually reads the audiobook, we also recorded that for her, and she got it, you know, with my Italian friends. So it's that was a lot of fun.
I'm talking to Tracy Barone, author of the new novel Happy Family. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Tracy, as your debut novel, can I ask, how long did it take you to write the novel?
Well, I got to tell you, Nicole, it took a decade for me to write this. So I would say that it was, you know, I wrote it in fits and starts, and I was doing other things. I was raising a daughter. I was a single mom, and I was, you know, still doing some film stuff and consulting. But I, you know, the novel just kept tugging on me and tugging on me and wouldn't let me go. And being a sort of perfectionist, I, you know, wrote and rewrote, and it took me a better part of 10 years.
Well, 10 years is kind of par for the course on the show.
I guess so. Okay, good. Now I don't feel like I'm such a slowpoke there. But yeah, it takes a while.
Yeah. How did you find your agent?
I was really lucky on this. My agent, Susan Gollum, I found through my friend A.M. Holmes, who gave a lovely blurb and was a big supporter of the book. And she had sent the novel to a couple of people, and Susan responded immediately and, you know, said, I just have to have this. And I was like, great. And we were sort of kind of a done deal.
Wow.
So it was a very kind of kismet thing.
Without getting into plot spoilers, I need to ask you whether you knew your ending early on. Did you write towards that ending with it in mind? Or
yes, I knew the very ending. I knew the epilogue, and I knew where I was. I always knew where I was going. I didn't always know how I was going to get there. And that's, you know, at least with this novel, I knew the beginning, and I knew the end, and I knew certain key parts. But you know, what's great about writing to me is the surprise. You know, is that you think you're going one way, and then, you know, you realize, oh no, you're going a complete other way. And that's always really fun.
Were you able to take that kind of liberty when doing playwriting and screenwriting? Because I know there are certain points you have to hit, and it's structured in such a different way. But
yeah, screenwriting and playwriting. Playwriting, they're each different. So I'll say, for playwriting, yes. For playwriting, you know, there is much more, or at least for me, there is much more of that surprise element, because it wasn't, you know, as structured. Screenwriting, to me, it's like you're really the architect. You know, you're building something. You've got plans, but you know, filmmaking is a director's medium. It's really thinking in pictures. So, I think that the writing of a screenplay, number one, is so much more collaborative. You know, you have so many different people giving you input, and you've got, you know, act one, act two, act three. So it's. I would say that playwriting was much more freeform than that, and I could find much more discovery within that. But there's always a process of discovery in writing. I mean, that's what makes it so much fun and so baffling sometimes, because just when you thought you've got it all figured out, no, your character tells you they want to go in another direction, or, you know, you write 30 pages and you realize, oh, now I'm just starting. This is, forget all that. This is the moment.
Well, Tracy, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, do you have any advice for the writers listening, especially those of us years into a debut project that, you know, we're in the weeds with?
I would say, number one, I would say for anybody, you know, it's like, it's never too late or too early to start or to reinvent yourself. I mean, look at me, I had a whole other career, and I'm like, you know, 50 plus and having a debut novel. So I'd say that. And I'd also say, you know, don't leave, write it all, put it all out there. And if you're in the weeds, if you're stuck, you know, take a step back, but always keep moving forward. You know, keep moving forward, jump to another section if the section you're working on doesn't work, and get to the end, you know, get to the end, and you can always go back and change something. You know, perfectionism is a curse, and I know I struggled with that. So, if there's one thing I would say, it's, you know, fail and then fail harder and keep going.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tracy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole.
That was Tracy Barone, author of the new novel Happy Family, hot off the press, just released by Lee Boudreau Books. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for The Come Down with Jessica Lowe coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.